48 hours on and then has a few days off, will start a landscaping or a painting company. He has no intention of quitting the fire department, but his unique schedule frees him up to pursue all kinds of small business ideas. The best part-time job is very possibly a small business idea. I have nothing against Burger King, but why flop Whoppers at minimum wage when there are a million small business ideas you could start with today? There's no point in remaining unemployed, quote, looking for work. Work isn't really hard to find if you look at the needs people have and how you might serve them. A micro business begun on a part-time basis may or may not become a big deal. But again, there is no shame in starting small. Time to jump. So when is it time to quit your day job so you can devote all your energies to your new small business? Most people get so excited that they tend to want to quit too soon. I suggest you wait until the boat pulls up to the dock before you jump in. What I mean is, if you quit your day job before you get your small business net income up high enough, you will miss the boat and become all wet. So I look at two things when helping an entree leader decide when it is time to make the jump to full-time. One, how much are you making as a percentage of your day job? A young entree leader named Tim called to ask me if he could or should quit his full-time job and make the jump. Last year, he made $6,000 at his part-time graphic arts business. He works as a graphic artist for a big company making $70,000 a year. When we hear that, you and I instantly know that is too far to jump, and he will put his family in jeopardy if he does. So I prescribe that he increase his efforts and hours dramatically, working like a crazy man to get his income up. It is hard to work your day job and spend a ton of hours on your business, but it is harder to make a mistake and lose your home in foreclosure because you jumped before the boat was close enough to the dock. I recommended that he have 1 year of making at least $45,000 from his side job and then make the jump. This does two things. One, we know that he can actually make a living as a small business person. And two, with making $70,000 at the day job plus $45,000 from his business, he should be able to build up a nice cushion in his savings, making the jump more likely to work. He won't starve out. The second factor when deciding if you're ready to jump is to consider how the income is trending from your small business. In the case of our graphic artist, Tim, if he has shown a steady and predictable increase in income, he might make the jump sooner rather than waiting a whole year. Last year he made $6,000, which is $500 per month. So what if next month he makes $1,000, and the next month $2,000, and the next month $3,000, and the next month $8,000, and the next month $9,000? Then he has shown that the business grows based on his increased effort, so dropping the day job that is now paying less per month is not as tough a decision. But apply common sense to this analysis. If all this income is coming from one client, you aren't ready to jump. If this increased income is proof that a well-diversified client base and an excited marketplace exists, then you can make the jump after a good six-month trend. Time to expand your company? One of the scariest decisions is when to hire that first team member. Really, every hire is scary up until you have 10 to 15 team members. As I teach small business people, I'm often asked how to decide if you're ready to expand. The answer? Use the same thought process that we just discussed for deciding to go full-time. You should be putting in ridiculous hours that are all creating extra income for several months to ensure you really need help. Just being overworked isn't enough. You need to have income created by that work to pay people. Seems obvious, but a lot of people go from a micro business to hiring just because they are tired, not because they're profitable. Small business is not for wimps. Suck it up until you make a profit. Then you can expand. Until you're making a profit, you don't have anything you want more of anyway. Passion matters. Calling matters. Seth Godin says, instead of wondering when your next vacation is, maybe you should set up a life you don't need to escape from. Business is way too hard to work at something just for money. Winning at business at times requires that you exhaust every ounce of spiritual, emotional, and physical energy you have. You won't put that effort in day in and day out, year in and year out, just for money. Money is great, but it ultimately is an empty goal. Bigger homes, bigger cars, and even more giving is just not big enough to keep you creative and energized throughout your life. You have to have a passion, a higher calling to what you engage in. Malcolm Gladwell says, hard work is a prison cell only if the work has no meaning. So only the spiritually and emotionally immature person picks a business to go into simply because they think they can make a lot of money. Find something you love doing so much that on the tough days, you have a reason to fight on. The why of your business has to be so big that it keeps you on fire and even bleeds over to your team and ignites them. Simon Sinek does a great TED Talk. TED is an online motivational series about people and companies who win because they get the why of their calling. He calls it the golden circle. Picture three rings making a bullseye. In the center ring, you have why. In the middle ring, you have how. In the outer ring, you have what. As Sinek explains it, every company knows what they do, their product or service. Most companies know how they do it, their process or workflow, but very few companies know why they do it at all. The companies that really get the why of their business, their purpose, their reason for existing, are the ones that win big time. They operate from the inside out, pushing their why out through their how and what. That way, everything they do, from products to processes, is centered on the very core, the heart of their mission. The bottom line for businesses, according to Sinek, is that people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. The goal is not to do business with everybody who needs what you have, the what. The goal is to do business with the people who believe what you believe, the why. This isn't just about products either. It's about people. He explains that if you hire somebody just because they need a job, the what, they'll work for your money. But if you hire someone who believes what you believe, the why, they'll give you their blood, sweat, and tears. Selecting a business. The moral of this section of the story is that you can and should make money, lots of it. But for the long term, select something that causes a chill to run down your spine. Whether you are selecting a business for the long term or for the short term financial goal, there is seldom a need for you to make a huge lurching change in the direction of your life. If you are trying to make some extra cash and you are a graphic artist, don't go try to get an accounting degree. Just open up your laptop and design yourself some great graphic artist business cards. If you're a bookkeeper or accountant, you don't have to get a PhD in art appreciation to make some extra money. Just start doing books for some small business people who need your help. Dan Miller, that I mentioned earlier, wrote a book called 48 Days to the Work You Love. Dan says you should always begin building your life bouquet from those flowers that are within reach. He further says that your career choice or small business choice should be a reflection of three main areas. First, your skills and abilities. What have you been trained for, and what are your natural talents? I'm very good at math. It is a natural and a trained talent. So finance is a place I feel very comfortable. Second, personality traits. I am a people person and very task-oriented, but not good at details. So even though I am good at math and could make a lot of money, being a tax accountant would make me want to shoot myself every day. And third, values, dreams, and passions. I don't believe in debt, so it would be inconsistent with my values for me to sell something every day, all day, that involved the customer going into debt. I would be miserable. So, on its most primitive level, gathering flowers within reach for a part-time business just to make money simply means you should do something you know and have the tools to do. If you have a lawnmower, you can cut grass. If you have a car, you can deliver pizzas. If you know accounting and have a computer, you can keep books. Simple. However, at its deeper level, gathering this bouquet means really growing and searching out the life mystery of why you were put on the planet. Only select a business to be in as a career choice that meets the three principles I just mentioned. passion trumps obstacles and age. I have often heard people thinking of living their dream through the opening of a business who are concerned they might be too old. The interesting thing that I've observed is that while the corporate world seems to have a tendency to throw away a talented 53-year-old, that same 53-year-old likely is in for the best income decade of his or her life. It has been my observation as a financial counselor over 20 years that the decade of your 50s is likely to be your greatest income decade of your life if you don't quit dreaming and looking for your passion. If you have been discarded by the corporate world, you should approach the next chapter of your life like they did you a favor, because they did. You are never too old. You are never the wrong color. You are never too disabled. You are never the wrong political party. There is never a big enough obstacle to keep a person with passion operating in a higher calling from winning. Is it tougher for a 5-foot-something Pistol Pete Maravich to play in the NBA than a really tall guy? Sure, but he practiced and dreamed so hard that he did it. I hope this little personal pep rally reminds you how important it is for you to select a business that you are passionate about. If you choose well, the way you spend most of your life, your vocation will truly be a vacation. Two popular approaches to starting a company are franchising and multi-level marketing, or MLMs. I have to tell you, I'm an entrepreneur's entrepreneur, and neither of these is right for me, but they might be right for you. I go over this in detail in the online bonus materials for this book, but the main thing to keep in mind is do your research. Do not get involved before you've investigated the company thoroughly and really thought about the drawbacks as well as the potential. Conclusion. So this is the chapter where businesses are born. If you are already in business or you are leading within someone else's company, it is good for you to ingest this information so you remember or you know what is in the DNA of your company. Your mighty oak was once a very scared little acorn. Your big train was once the little engine that could. You need to remember that the things covered in this chapter are what drive our economy. And keep that sense of healthy desperation, that sense of entrepreneurship, and that thrill of stepping out to create where no man has gone before. The exciting unknown is the essence of business. And in that sense, all business is small business. Business is easy until people get involved. Hiring, firing, and personality styles. Jean had to be let go, fired. Her big personality, her big mouth, and her open, belligerent disrespect for me, and her gossip spreading throughout our little office left me no choice. There were only about 12 of us in those days, and so one bad apple represented almost 10% of my entire staff. She was our only salesperson, and she was doing well with sales, which made her get confused as to the level of power she had in our little company. I wasn't scared of her, but I let the trash go on so long that I began to fear what would happen when I let her go. Would I lose clients? Would some of the other team members leave angrily because they were more loyal to her than to me? By being too nice and extending too much grace, I had let several layers of misbehavior go on 6 months too long, and now I was actually having some fear about my business because of an employee. Ridiculous. The morning I fired her, I got to the office early to pray and rehearse my speech. I had warned her, I had reprimanded her, and I had let this go on way too long. As I sat there watching the early commuters fight traffic outside my office window, I wondered to myself how I had let this mess happen and get so out of hand. From that morning meeting with Jean, complete with her attitude and the process of letting people go in the early days of my business, I quickly began to form a philosophy regarding adding and subtracting from my team. I will tell you that when that woman left our company, our customers and our team rejoiced. I felt like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz after she accidentally killed the Wicked Witch. To my surprise, all the players cheered, celebrated. I started realizing that I was making mistakes in hiring and even in firing because I didn't know what I was doing. Most businesses are horrible at hiring and firing. Now, years later, and hundreds of team members later, in my leadership growth, I have become very good at both hiring and very rarely firing. I am so good at it that I am convinced this may be one of the most important chapters in this book. Our team is so central to our success that our interaction with them as they come in the door and even as they go out the door is vital, fluid, and very intentional. Turnover is bad for business. Proper hiring creates a good team, and a good team lowers turnover. Turnover is very expensive, particularly in small business. When you lose a team member, not only is their job not getting done, but oftentimes your job isn't getting done because you have to stop what you are doing and begin the interview process again. Plus, new team members have to be trained. That takes time away from other tasks. And the new team members take a while to become good at their task, costing you even more productivity. Using the philosophies and process covered here, we have lowered our turnover to about 4% per year. The first and often the largest mistake we make in hiring is we don't take enough time. Take more time. Take more time. I know how it is, and especially how the first few hires are. You are going along doing business, and you look up and realize 80-hour weeks are becoming a way of life, so you have a revelation. I need to hire someone to help me. So you begin to hire people quickly, because you don't have time to actually do an interview. In your rush to get some help, you are extremely naive and actually think after one or two quick interviews that you found someone who will love and rock your baby business with you. Very quickly after they enter your life, you find they don't care as much as you or work as hard as you. And hey, they don't even show up on time. If you keep this up, you will have a building full of employees. Huh. You remember the definition of an employee, don't you? An employee is someone who comes late, leaves early, and steals while they're there. You don't want employees. You want team members. And the process of adding team members requires you to slow down the hiring process. Take more time. The person hired properly will perform better, will not cause problems, and will be more likely to stay. Once we realized it is much easier and takes less time to go through a lengthy hiring process rather than rehire the position three times, our quality of life got better. When you work with fired up, talented people who love what they do, you have more fun than trying to gather a bunch of turkeys together and whip some work out of them. The process of building and nurturing a team that has low turnover takes more time per person employed, but it takes much less time than interviewing, onboarding, training, and then firing three turkeys before you luck into a good person. We use at least 12 components in our hiring process. It takes an average of 6 to 15 interviews and an average of 90 days from initial contact to hire. If you had told me to do that when I started, I would have laughed and found some reason that all this didn't apply to me and my business. If you are thinking this is overkill, I have a challenge for you. Try this process, or your version of it, for your next 5 hires, and see if you don't lower turnover and drama, as well as increase the quality of your life and the lives of the rest of your team. Just try something new. Our goal is to find out someone is not a good fit before we hire them. My human resources director has a great saying. He says we have a 95% turnover before we hire them. That means if you make it to the second interview, you still only have a 1 in 20 chance of getting hired. 12 components to a good hire. Number 1, prayer. As a person of faith, I ask God to send me who He wants to work with me to do the work He gave me. I also ask God to keep the crazy people away so I can get my work done. Sometimes He answers that prayer. If you are not a person of faith, at least spend some quiet time in the morning thinking about the type of person you want to work with every day and the type of person you don't want on your team. Several members of our team have weird stories about how they connected with us at just the right time and in just the right way to be hired on our team. Some of the circumstances are such bizarre and unusual methods of getting a job that they are convinced God sent them. Over the years, I have become thoroughly convinced they are right. Number two, advertise and get referrals. We have found most employment advertising to be a waste of money. We're not trying to collect thousands of resumes. We are instead trying to find someone who fits on our team and wants to join our crusade. We do have an employment section on our website, and you will find our ads full of enough information for you to rule yourself out. You can rule yourself out if you see the position for video editor pays in the $45,000 range, and you want to make $90,000. If that is the case, you would only want to work for us if you are brain damaged. And in that case, we wouldn't want you. You can also rule yourself out if the position clearly states you must have certain proven skills, like 2 years of accounting experience required, or must know cold fusion. Put too much info in your ads wherever you run them so people can rule themselves out and you don't have to. By far, our most successful hiring procedure is referrals from existing team members. We pay our team a bounty of $250 in cash, handed out and applauded in a staff meeting when we hire someone they sent us, and that person makes it through the 90-day probation period. And every time we hand out that money in a meeting, we remind the whole group to be careful and send us only their friends who are rock stars and not to send us friends who are turkeys or drama queens. Number three, the 30-minute drive-by interview. You should never hire someone in one interview, ever. Your first interview should be a quick, get-to-know-you conversation to begin the process or call someone out quickly. My team quit letting me do interviews long ago because I'm awful at it. The worst thing I do, if I'm not really careful, is spend 2 hours telling you how great we are, only to discover later that you're not even qualified. I love people and I love what we do, so I talk about it too much. It is oxymoronic because I can take a call on my talk radio show and get you to tell me things in 2 minutes that you never should in front of 5 million people. But I'm a crummy interviewer. My HR director is a fabulous interviewer, as well he should be. He can learn all kinds of things in 30 minutes that you never intended to tell him. No tricks or fancy interview questions. He just listens and asks questions. He says in a drive-by 30-minute interview, use the ratio of 2 ears to 1 mouth. Listen 20 minutes and talk for 10 minutes. Listen much more than you talk. Don't go 31 minutes. Cut it off, because you two will be talking again many times if there is a reason. Number four, resume and references. This is the most worthless of the 12 components to a good hire, but it is still needed. You need a resume so you can quickly get to the formal training someone has that pertains to the position you're filling. Other than that, a resume is a great place to begin several conversations where you will discover what the person is really about. Since most people have the good sense to put down only references who will say good things about them, references are generally useless. We do check references because if the person is stupid enough to list references who don't know we are going to call, or stupid enough to list references who aren't going to say nice things about them, then we consider them too stupid to hire. Number five, testing tools. Too many companies use testing tools as a key component in hiring. You and your leaders need to have enough relational intelligence to determine who to bring on without giving undue weight to some kind of magic test that will tell all. However, we do use testing tools as one of the indicators of a good fit in hiring. The tool we always order after the second or third interview is the DISC personality test. This tool gives us a quick look at the personality style of the person. We want to see if their style fits with the particular job, how their style will fit with the team they will join, and how they will interact with the style of their immediate leader. This is a quick test of 20-something questions that just takes a few minutes, but reveals with fairly good accuracy a person's tendencies. The DISC test. I avoid IQ tests and other measures of raw intelligence because they are not good indicators of success. Malcolm Gladwell found in his research for the book Outliers that IQ or GPA is seldom an indicator of success. A greater indicator is relational intelligence, The ability to get along with others and work with others to achieve shared goals is huge as an indicator of winning. While it's not an indicator of relational intelligence, your personality style does matter. And the way to measure this is through the DISC test, D-I-S-C. The D stands for dominance. A dominant person is a very task-oriented, hard-driving person who looks to solve problems and is always asking when. Gary Smalley, an author on marriage, assigns animals to these styles and calls this person a lion. They roar. They overlook details. They can hurt people's feelings, but they really get stuff done. They are quick to act and make decisions easily. And if they don't like that decision, they will make another. They make great team members because they will always keep the company moving. About 10% of the public is the D personality. The I stands for influencer. This person is people-oriented, fun, outgoing, and generally a party looking for a place to happen. They are very concerned about people and are always asking who. They are expressive, persuasive, lose focus on tasks, and make decisions quickly. Usually, because they are impulsive, Smalley calls these people otters. They are really fun to be around and to have on your team. About 25% of the public is the I personality. The S stands for steady. This person is unbelievably loyal and stable. They detest conflict and are paralyzed by it. They love people and are concerned about how everyone feels. They are a team player, understanding and amiable. Smalley calls this type a golden retriever, and everyone should have one as a friend. They will be with you to the end and love you in spite of your flaws. They are slow to make decisions because they always want to understand why. And they want to make sure no people are hurt because they always avoid conflict. They are great team members because they are very loyal and steady. About 40% of the public is the S quadrant personality. The C stands for compliant. This person is all about details and is consequently very analytical and factual and loves the rules. You must know the rules and follow the rules if you are a C style. Not following the rules is not only wrong, it represents a failure of integrity. These people can seem rigid and resistant to change, but they will always have high levels of competency. They are slow to make decisions because they must first gather all the facts and details, and they are always asking how. People are not so much on their radar, and if people show up, they should be studied. Gary calls the C personality the beaver. These people are very industrious and all about business. They make excellent team members, and you for sure want some in your accounting department. About 25% of the public is the C personality. We never use this test as a deal breaker on a hire. What we are trying to do with all 12 of these components is to establish a pattern toward or away from hiring. We never hire someone when half of the 12 go poorly. And we almost never rule someone out exclusively on one of the 12. Your organization needs some of every personality or you will have serious problems. My three closest leaders and I fall in each of the four quadrants respectively, which ensures that when we make group decisions, they are generally wise. If we were all one type or another, we would miss all kinds of elements. There are a few personalities that are wrong for certain positions. You probably don't want an I personality who hates details, loves people, and is impulsive in your accounting department. So the first question we ask ourselves is how the potential hire's personality is going to fit the position interviewed for. The second thing we are looking for is how they will fit the chemistry of the group they will be working with. If the group is all high energy and artistic, how is a C personality who loves rules going to fit in? They might, but the strengths and weaknesses of the chemistry need to be discussed as part of the hiring procedure. The last thing we are looking for is how they are going to work with their leader. If you are hiring a sweet young lady who is a high S and doesn't like conflict to work directly for a gruff old D who is blunt and task-oriented, She is going to cry every day. That won't work. I am a high D and right on the line of I. So my assistant, who has been with me for years, is perfect as a C with some S. She compliments me well, but we also share some tendencies. You also want to keep in mind that lazy is not a personality style. It is a character flaw. Having no initiative is not a style. It is a character flaw. I mention this because we've had people who didn't want to work hard quit and tell us their personality style didn't fit in. Not true. It was that we require huge work ethic, and they didn't have that character quality. Lazy is not a style. I have trained my leaders to spend time with people in the hiring process to determine if they play well with others. That will be the only way you can build a great culture and actually enjoy your team. Now, back to the steps we take in hiring. Number 6, do you like them? In most cases, you are going to be working really closely with the people you hire. For goodness sakes, don't force yourself to work with people you don't like or don't have anything in common with. There are some people you don't need to hire simply because you don't like them. That is good enough. The last time I hired a personal assistant, George W. Bush had just been elected president for the first time. And by the way, I'm a huge W fan, which matters in this story. Some of my team had interviewed and narrowed down the candidates to two. One lady came to interview with me, and she was very qualified. She had been the personal assistant to the president of a Fortune 100 company, and she was very polished and buttoned down. As I was talking with her, I asked which of our books or classes she was familiar with. She said she had listened to me give financial advice on the radio, but hadn't read any of the books or been through any of the classes. That was fine, but it just told me she would have a learning curve about what we do. Then she jumped in and offered that the advice we give, helping people with their money, was going to be sorely needed in America now that we had elected that clown, George W. Wow, she was picking on a guy I like. I have hired plenty of people different than me. We've even hired a few Alabama football fans, and I think I saw a Florida Gators shirt the other day. So that's a sign our screening procedures need to be stepped up. Just kidding, in case you can't tell. But the moral of the story is my personal assistant works in virtually every detail in my life, so they should be someone I really like. Plus, if you are going to interview with a CEO and every opinion he has ever had is somewhere on the internet, have enough sense to do some research before you go to the meeting. Had our candidate in question done that, her interview might have lasted longer. Hire people you like. You will be trusting them and spending lots of time with them. There is a ridiculous unwritten rule that if you are professional enough, you can overlook vast differences in value systems. You might, but why bother? I would rather pay my money to and spend time with people I actually like. Number 7, do they light up? We hired a young lady who had been working with troubled teens in a program at the YMCA and before that had been involved with a teen ministry called Young Life. We did not hire her to work with retirees. She is in our youth resources department. And please don't ask her what she does. If you do, an hour later, you will leave exhausted because she is so very fired up about helping teens learn to handle money. She is a rock star, partly because she lights up when the subject comes up. For her, it is just a bonus that we pay her. She would practically volunteer because she loves and is passionate about her role on our team. When you start talking about the position, or when the candidate starts talking about the position, do they light up? Does the mere thought of getting to do the work at hand fire them up? Or are they just looking for a J-O-B? If all they want is a paycheck, you will never keep them happy. We are looking for people to plug in to the opportunistic motivation and the philosophical motivation of what we do. We are a successful, moving, and growing company that represents a great business opportunity for team members. Someone joining our team can grow with us, and that is how you should present any position within your team. They need to love the business orientation and speed with which we operate, or they won't fit in. A potential team member should also fit with the philosophy of what you do. Since I am obviously an unabashed Christian, lots of people of faith love that aspect of what we do. Someone should be able to embrace the loving people part of our philosophy to fit in with our team. We have found that people we hire who don't possess some of each of the opportunistic and the philosophical understanding of our company don't last because they don't fit in. I have had nice Christian people come to work for me because somehow they got the idea Christian is code for don't have to work hard. They were in for a big surprise. They must have thought we sat around all day singing Kumbaya. One lady quit because she said we were all about making money. My response to her was, I noticed she kept cashing her paychecks, so she must be all about the money too. On the other side of the coin, we have had people join us who were only excited about making money. So when we stopped what we were doing and helped some hurting people, it didn't compute in their brain. They didn't fit in either. You have to have both components to fit my company. 8. Personal budget and mission statement. You know to have a mission statement for your business. And you should build a personal mission statement as well. Very few people are nerdy enough to come to us for an interview with their personal mission statement already done. However, we do show people our mission statement in the interview process. And if they go through the whole process and are hired, we require everyone to build a personal mission statement. We want their statement to show how the position they accepted is them living their dream. Did you know that if you hire people who are broke, they don't make good team members? If someone has financial problems, they can't concentrate on work because they are constantly worried about their bills. Broke people struggle at work. I found this out the hard way with one of my first hires. I hired this sweet little lady from my church to be one of our first all-purpose secretaries. I had known her for years, and she was so sweet, until we hired her. Then she became the meanest woman I've ever seen. She barked, snapped, and snarled at my other team members, and even at customers. I was aghast. We were just starting, and I was already a failure as a leader. So I called her into my office and asked her what her problem was. "I'm stressed out," was her answer, to which I said, "No kidding. What's wrong?" It turned out, as I dug into her situation, that she wasn't making enough to pay her bills. She had a lot of marketable skills, and before she worked for me, had been making really good money, but was laid off from that job. When I sat with her and worked up a monthly budget, I discovered that I hired her for $14,000 per year less than she needed to pay her bills. No wonder she was stressed. I couldn't believe someone would take a job that didn't pay enough to meet their obligations, especially when she could have gotten a better paying job and chose us instead. I asked her why she would do such a thing, and she told me she believed so strongly in what we were doing that God would provide a way for her to pay her bills. I told her how much we appreciated her, and then I told her that God says she's fired because he can add. We laughed, and since I could not afford to pay her what she needed and what she was worth, I helped her find a new job. I never hired another team member after that day without first getting a budget from them to make sure that they could live on what we were paying for that position. As a leader, it is my job to serve my team well by making sure they can care for their family and meet their obligations with what I pay. Number 9, compensation calculation, benefits, and policy review. As we go through the different interviews, we always go deeper into detail and develop exactly how a team member will be paid. We unpack the benefits we offer, and we go over our core values and operating principles in detail before we hire someone. We will spend a whole chapter on developing creative compensation plans, but for the purposes of an interview, remember that people whose first question is about pay are not people you want. If they are preoccupied by pay and benefits, you will never do enough or pay enough to make them happy because they are just looking for a J-O-B and not an opportunity with work that matters. I have met sharp young people and been disappointed that in the first 3 minutes of the interview, they want to know what I'm going to do for them, not what they can do for the team. 10. Key results areas. before you even post a position, you need to have a written, detailed job description. We call our job description a listing of key results areas, KRAs. You need to define in detail what winning in that position looks like. What are the key touchstones that will make you, the leader, thrilled you hired them? Writing out the key results areas really helps you to define who you are looking for, as well as clearly communicates what the position entails. I am amazed how many times you can hire the wrong person when you haven't clearly written down what you want them to do. We have hired people who quit when they came on board and discovered what the job really was. A key result area can be as simple as defining the number of calls and sales volume required in a sales position. It will further define what should happen on that certain number of calls made per week. Our receptionist, our director of first impressions, has as KRA number one, answer all incoming calls within two rings with a smile, because a smile changes the shape of your vocal cords and your face. A customer can hear the smile on the phone. Three rings is unacceptable because the caller thinks no one is home. And her number two KRA is no one is on hold longer than 17 seconds. Because, as George Carlin used to say, hold is a lonely place. Number 11, spousal interview. This may be the best advice in this whole audiobook. I mentioned in Chapter 4 on making the call that I get Sharon's input on big decisions, including big business decisions. A hire is a huge decision. The last interview we do is an informal dinner with the department leader and their spouse, and the hire and their spouse. With the first 40 people we hired, Sharon and I went to dinner with the hire and their spouse. We started doing this so I could get Sharon's input and see if she got some kind of feeling about them. This has given us several other great benefits also. One, we not only get to meet the hire's spouse and get to know them before they join our team, we can solicit their input on whether they think this position will work for their spouse. You would be amazed by the number of times a spouse, after meeting us and hearing the details of the job, will speak up and say they don't think this is a good fit. We just saved ourselves a ton of trouble. Also, we get to tell our story with the spouse and share some of how we run our company and let them say if they think it's a good fit. One of the biggest benefits I have found in this process, which I didn't recognize on the front end, is by doing the spousal interview, you will discover if your hire is married to crazy. Have you ever hired a great person whose crazy spouse completely took away their ability to win because they were doing maintenance on crazy? I was interviewing a very sharp young man for our broadcast department and explained to him that our final interview would be an informal dinner with his spouse. A few hours later, I got a screaming and cussing phone call from his wife. She blew a gasket at the very thought that she had to be involved in her husband's hiring. After she yelled and cussed for a minute or two, she finally asked me, laced with profanity, that I'll leave out, "Why do you do this spouse interview anyway?" To which I responded, "To find people like you. That poor guy gets his backbone ripped out every morning, and maybe she gives it back to him at night if she hears a noise outside." Either he is a complete jellyfish, their marriage will end up in counseling, or they will get divorced. None of those options sounds like a productive team member. So the spousal interview might help you discover if the person is married to crazy. If they are, stay away. 12. 90-day probation. Once a person is hired, they are on a 90-day probation, and we have very little obligation to them during that time. Likewise, we tell them that our company is on probation with them, and they have very little obligation to us during that time. They are welcome to walk in and quit. We probably won't release them without lots of discussions because we have invested heavily at this point, but we have a low obligation. After 90 days, though, we take serving our team and working with them very seriously. The funniest story about probation is the young man we hired into our call center who had owned a landscape company since he was 16. Translation, for 10 years he'd been cutting grass and doing other miscellaneous landscaping duties. He told our leader that he wanted a real job inside. So after going through all the interviewing and other components, he was hired and started on a Monday. About 11 a.m., as he was sitting in the call center taking calls, he jumped up, ripped off his headset, and ran out the door. He jumped in his car and drove off. In a few hours, our leader got a call from him explaining that he just couldn't stand to be inside that long. I really gave my call center leader a hard time about not asking if working inside was going to be a problem. Oh, brother. Subtracting. So that is how we add team members. But what happens when we need to subtract? What happens when team members fail? Team members eventually have to perform or they have to leave. There are only three reasons we find team members failing to the point we have to release them. When someone is failing, you should start by determining the root cause of the failure. Failure because of leadership failure. At least half of the times we've lost people due to underperformance, it was because of a leadership breakdown. I consider hiring someone who should have never been hired a leadership breakdown. So when someone is failing, ask yourself, did you goof with this hire? Do you have clear key results areas outlined so that the hire actually knows how winning is defined and measured? I have found that sometimes, even a year after a person was hired, somehow a clear description of winning had not been clearly communicated. That is a leadership problem, because the poor team member thought they were doing awesome. Was leadership in place to train and mentor the new person and continue to mentor them into new tasks? I actually had a VP hire a guy, and the guy's first day was the first day of the VP's two-week vacation. Unbelievable! The poor guy sat around having no idea what to do for 2 weeks and thinking his new leader was a clown because he made a clown-like move. When a team member is new or on a new task, our leadership is there to serve them by training and mentoring them through the newness of the process. Ask yourself if the failing team member was given the tools to win. Were the environment and all the resources in place for them to win? I actually discovered one time that we were taking 2 weeks after a hire to get a computer and a phone in place for a new team member. IT and HR got the opportunity to do better planning after that. You have a honeymoon with a new team member when they are very enthused, excited, and energized. Don't let all the air out of their balloon by not having a fast track in place for them to enter your team. Failure because of personal problems. If a team member has a personal problem that is causing them to fail at their job, the first thing you have to do is quantify the problem. Figure out how big the problem is. A lady on our team walked into my office with tears in her eyes and said, "My baby is sick." What does that mean? What is the illness? Well, that time the tears were because she was a first-time mom whose child had never been sick with the flu, and she'd never had to deal with how the daycare reacted. In a couple of days, everything was back to normal. No big deal. When Shauna from our accounting department came into my office one day and said, "My baby is sick," it turned out to mean her 3-year-old had leukemia. We had a whole different reaction. We let her have time off to deal with the chemo, with pay, and did not count it against her vacation. Some of our guys helped to keep their yard cut, and some of our ladies cooked their meals, while members of the accounting team rallied around and covered her work. Why? Because that is how I would want to be treated if my baby were sick. Treat your team like family, and they will act like family. Once you know how big the personal problem is, you can assess what to do for the team member and what to do about their job while they recover. You may need to pay for some professional help, such as marriage counseling. We have discovered that when a team member goes through a divorce, they are useless for at least 30 days before, during, or even after the divorce. Walking emotional zombies are not on their A game. You need to decide whether you can tolerate the lack of performance for a while or whether you need to staff around it. When dealing with a personal problem, you must see some incremental progress in order to give grace during the downtime. You have to see that they are going to come back to work after a crisis, or you will eventually have to act. always go too far in extending grace in the case of personal problems, because you will never have regrets that way. Failure caused by incompetence. If the team member isn't failing because of a leadership breakdown or a personal problem, then it is usually some kind of incompetence. Keep in mind, incompetence isn't evil. We are all incompetent at something. Quantify the incompetence. Many times you can pay for some training and or mentor someone through a rough spot to get them where they are able to perform. Sometimes, though, the incompetence is a character or a behavior issue. Is there an integrity problem, or are they stealing? In those cases, nothing can be done, and you should release them immediately. If they have other behavior issues, that is a type of incompetence, and you may be able to train them in how to act. As a hard-charging guy, I used to have a tendency to think anyone who wasn't moving at the speed of Dave was lazy. I have discovered, as my leadership ability increased, that a lot of people I thought were lazy really weren't. They just didn't have clear direction. So check first to make sure someone you think is lazy is being led well. But sometimes you will actually encounter someone who is just full-on hound dog lazy. There is no cure for these folks. Just release them as quickly as you can. The most frustrating type of incompetence I have dealt with is the person who gets their work done but never quite rings the excellence bell. And you come to realize they never will. There are some positions where you can tolerate that, but in a small business, there really isn't any margin for that kind of behavior. I had a man who had been with us about 3 years, and he could just never get there. Any team that had to work with him would come away frustrated, and there was always finger-pointing in all directions. His leader recommended several times that we release him, but I wouldn't because I couldn't put my finger on an exact behavior that we could demand change for. I like clarity, and I always want to give someone clear direction for the change required if they want to stay on the team. Jim Collins got this guy fired. Jim wrote the book Good to Great. In his chapter about getting the right people on the bus, he makes a statement that I have used in finance for years. Jim said to ask yourself this about a problem team member. If you hadn't hired them yet, would you hire them again? My answer was a quick no. So the next morning, we worked up a generous severance package, and my really nice but incompetent guy was released. If I would never hire that guy again in a million years, why was I keeping him? I promise you, the air in the building changed the next day. It was as if the whole organization had a splinter removed. Components of a release. Isn't it weird that we say phrases like release or let go when it comes to firing? Even the saying to fire someone means to discharge, which comes from discharging or firing a gun. It is almost as if we were holding something captive and we released it. In truth, that is the case, and you will discover when someone doesn't belong on your team, you are doing them a huge favor to set them free. The longer I have led, the more clear this truth has become to me. Always treat people with dignity and be generous as you set them free. But have the courage to do so, and you will actually be friends with some of the people you go through the process with. I have actually gotten thank you notes many times from people we have set free. Sometimes it is a few months later, and sometimes years later. But it is not unusual for someone to send me an email or letter thanking me for how I treated them and telling me how they are actually doing better now that they are somewhere else. Just like there are components to hiring, there are components to releasing someone properly. Releasing someone immediately. If you discover a character flaw like an integrity problem or stealing, the team member has to leave immediately that day. If there are other character issues like laziness or things you can't let happen in the company, you have to act on that as soon as you come to that conclusion. I have zero tolerance for the mistreatment of ladies. The current culture calls it sexual harassment. But I call it trash. and won't tolerate it for 1 second in our company. I also won't let a team member stay if they decide to have an affair. If their spouse can't trust them, neither can I. Those are the types of things that cause someone who has been with us 10 minutes or 10 years to be let go quickly after we discover it. Of course, people with other problems like drug use or addictions can't be part of our team either. Gone that day. But let them keep their dignity. James Ryle says, truth without love equals harshness, and love without truth is compromise. Always treat people how you would want to be treated. I had to release a leader who had an affair, and that was really tough. Not only were we friends, but he left a huge hole in my company. He was so broken and so ashamed, but still could not stay. We are friends to this day, partly because of how the whole situation was handled. I was honest with him about how hurt and disappointed I was in him, as his friend, and as his leader. But I was never angry or condescending, just hurt. He got tons of severance, and we are still friends. But he knew he couldn't work here if he had an affair. Regardless of the reason for the release, treat people right and with kindness. You are in control, and you still have a job. They have neither, so be kind. My goal today is to never surprise someone with a release and to give someone every opportunity to change so they can stay on the team. So when there is a problem with a team member's behavior or competence, we communicate that very clearly and very often. Reprimands. We start with verbal, coarse corrections that fall under the heading of a reprimand. These reprimands are not some kind of HR file filler where we write someone up. They are paternal instructions on how you must adjust in order to stay. It might be as simple as sitting down and reminding someone that our office opens at 8:30, and if they come in at 8:45, they are a thief. I am paying them, and when they are late, they are stealing. Ouch! That makes the point, and it's true. Some people view tardiness as a harmless behavior, but when we put it in those terms, that it's stealing, it helps them see how seriously we view it. A reprimand done properly should do 5 things. First, be short. Don't camp out and spend an hour verbally assaulting someone. Second, be uncomfortable for everyone. If you love reprimanding people, you are a bully. You should not avoid, but neither should you relish giving a reprimand. Third, attack the problem. Love the sinner and hate the sin. Ken Blanchard, in his classic The 1 Minute Manager, says to use the reprimand sandwich when you are doing a reprimand. Praise, problem, then praise again makes a nice sandwich. I have been guilty of serving a reprimand sandwich with no bread. And from personal experience, I know it didn't have the long-term desired effect. Fourth, be private. Never reprimand someone in front of someone else. You will lose their loyalty forever. And fifth, be gentle. You are teaching and course correcting in a reprimand, so you owe it to the person to be brutally clear, but you can do that with kindness. Some days, leadership is unbelievably tough. It requires that you walk through the pain of really rough decisions that are best for everyone in the long term, but hurt deeply in the short term. When it comes to releasing someone from your team, it is a really tough call if you love people well. Releasing someone should never become too easy, or you are in a danger zone. However, you will learn to pull the trigger gently and with dignity for the good of all involved, your company, its culture, and even the person leaving. Leaders who do this poorly and who don't act are doing damage to all the players on the team. Have the courage to do the right thing, the right way, at the right time, and you will be on your way to becoming an entree leader. Death of a Salesman, the Art of Selling by Serving. Picture in your mind 3 upscale custom homes side by side, immaculately furnished. Every detail in these homes was meticulously analyzed to make sure you want to own one when you walked through. the presentation of the master bedrooms, complete.